Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Rules of Persuasion, How the World's Greatest Communicators Convince, Inspire, Lead, and Sometimes Deceive, by Carlos A. Alvarenga. Afterword by James A. Arrieti, Ph.D., narrated by Carlos A. Alvarenga. Publisher's note: this audiobook contains references to material present in the print and ebook editions of the book. Introduction. Show not what has been done, but what can be. How beautiful the world would be if there were a procedure for moving through labyrinths. Umberto Eco, The Name of the Rose. In a memorable scene from Kevin MacDonald's 2006 film, The Last King of Scotland, the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin explodes in anger at his personal physician, Nicholas Garrigan, for allowing him to expel all the Asian nationals from the country. A hysterical Amin chastises Garrigan for not telling him to leave the Asians in peace. The terrified Garrigan defends himself by reminding Amin about the emphatic warning Garrigan had given that the expulsion would bring dire consequences and that the international press would condemn Amin mercilessly. "Yes," says Amin, "you told me all of these things, but you did not persuade me, Nicholas. You did not persuade me." I begin with this scene because it neatly encapsulates the problem this book examines. Why is it that human communication, which is almost exclusively aimed at persuasion, so often fails to persuade? How is it that very senior leaders, accomplished and successful in so many ways, struggle when asked to convince their boards or employees to follow them or embrace their ideas? On an everyday level, why is it that so many people fail to persuade colleagues, children, and friends when debating important issues or seeking support for a cause? Lastly, how is it that a corrupt communicator can persuade an entire nation to commit acts of savagery or injustice? Together we shall look at persuasion through what are, at the same time, very old and very new perspectives. The basic rules I will explain were first articulated by the philosopher Aristotle over 2,000 years ago in a work called Rhetoric. This book, by one of the foremost thinkers of the Western world has ever known, is a guide to how language and persuasion work. Contained within it is a simple claim with profound implications. Persuasion, Aristotle believed, works through three specific modes: character, argument, and emotion. For centuries, Aristotle's words inspired analysis, inquiry, and debate, and were a key part of all formal education across the Western world. In the second half of the 20th century, however, the study of rhetoric disappeared from most primary and secondary education and became an esoteric topic for specialists in classics, philosophy, and logic. There are pedagogical and historical reasons for this disappearance, and I will discuss them in my chapter on the dark side of persuasion. As we shall see, though, Aristotle's fundamental insights about the three essential elements of persuasion are as true today as they were over 2,000 years ago. Let this book be your guide into Aristotle's discoveries, updated for our time. It is not meant solely for an academic audience. Unlike many other books on the subject, I will not talk about the esoteric terms of rhetoric that are of little interest to specialists, much less to general listeners. I do not think a person needs to know what a syndeton and metonymy are to understand persuasion, or that there were five elements to classical oratory. Instead, we will look at how persuasion works all around us through the various means of communication that make up our world. This book is for anyone who wants to understand what persuasion is, how it functions, how to put its techniques to work, and how to critique their use in virtually any form of human communication: speeches, presentations, film, literature, social media, music, advertising, and visual art. From Homer to Shakespeare, from Magritte to Rothko, from Mao to Rakim, we will examine insights and concepts, some of them secret and powerful, which will fundamentally alter how we think about persuasion. In the end, my goal is to demonstrate that these insights can help make almost everyone a more thoughtful and persuasive communicator. So join me now as we embark upon a journey to discover the secrets of persuasion, the primary goal of human communication. A word about QR codes. As many of my persuasion examples are drawn from various media, in the print and ebook versions of this book, I have included QR codes next to any example that is available online. I strongly encourage you to experience the original media as you go through the analysis, especially in the first four chapters. 1. What is persuasion? Modern formulations are necessary even in defense of very ancient truths, not because any alleged anachronism in the old ideas. The Beatitudes remain, surely, the essential statement of the Western Code, but because the idiom of life is always changing. William F. Buckley, Jr., American Conservative Thought in the 20th Century. Defining persuasion, Aristotle's original insights. When we think about it, we soon come to realize that in almost every setting in which we speak with others, we are trying to persuade them of one thing or another. The validity of a fact, the value of an opinion, or to act or not act in a certain way. Across most walks of life, teaching, business, medicine, art, and so on, our success usually depends on inducing someone to agree with us about something or to do our bidding. Persuasion is fundamental to our lives. And yet, is it not remarkable that most people never study it or stop to wonder exactly what it is or how it works? One might think that if a thing is vital to the achievement of most of our important personal and professional goals, we would take pains to become experts in every nuance of its nature and constituent elements. But when it comes to persuasion, the average person knows much more about much less important matters. This is why the first question I ask when I start to coach someone in persuasion is to define the term. It is easier to become good at an activity if one understands its defining characteristics. Interestingly, everyone I have coached struggles to provide an explanation of persuasion. Some people talk about persuasion as an outcome. I got someone to do something. What others describe it is a desired state in a listener. My business partner agreed with me about something. In all cases, most agree that they do not have a clear definition of the term and are not able to articulate how persuasion functions. This lack of clarity about the definition of the term helps to explain why so many people struggle to be persuasive communicators. For a process not to produce a random outcome, it must have rules and techniques that govern how it works. We understand that physicians and musicians should be able to explain how medicine and music work, but in general, people do not stop to think about the rules and techniques of persuasion, nor do they wonder whether rules and techniques of persuasion exist. Well, they do exist, and were first explained by a person who has been one of the most influential thinkers in Western history. To call Aristotle only a philosopher is to do him a disservice. In his learned writings, he established the foundations of many disciplines, from botany to logic to epistemology to ethical reasoning. Sadly, only about a third of his writings survived antiquity. But in one of them, Aristotle explains exactly what persuasion is and how it works. For Aristotle, persuasion is a demonstration that something is true. It is important to think about his statement for a moment, since it has many implications. When he says that persuasion is a demonstration, it means that persuasion is an action. Moreover, persuasion depends on the existence of truth. For even when a speaker is trying to demonstrate not reality, but the approximation of what is real, both speaker and listener must know what truth is. This requirement is one of the most critical points that people often do not understand about persuasion. The speaker does not persuade. His proving of truth, or the appearance of truth, persuades. The communicator's job is to demonstrate truth. Once the listener concludes that truth has been established, persuasion should follow, assuming the listener is a rational person. Aristotle distinguishes between two kinds of persuasion: persuasion about knowing and persuasion about believing. And there were, and still are, very different kinds of demonstrations. Rhetoric is principally about the second kind of persuasion, which will also be the focus of our investigation. Having defined persuasion as a demonstration that something is true, Aristotle then presents the three ways in which persuasion can be effected. Of the modes of persuasion furnished by the spoken word, there are three kinds. The first kind depends on the personal character of the speaker. The second on putting the audience into a certain frame of mind, the third on the proof, or apparent proof, provided by the words of the speech itself. The first way persuasion works is through the character of the speaker. Persuasion is achieved by the speaker's personal character when the speech is so spoken as to make us think him credible. We believe good men more fully and more readily than others. This is true generally, whatever the question is, and absolutely true, where exact certainty is impossible and opinions are divided. This kind of persuasion, like the others, should be achieved by what the speaker says, not by what people think of his character before he begins to speak. It is not true, as some writers assume in their treatises on rhetoric, that the personal goodness revealed by the speaker contributes nothing to his power of persuasion. On the contrary, his character may almost be called the most effective means of persuasion he possesses. The last part of the sentence quoted is very important to us. Character may almost be called the most effective means of persuasion. Nothing Aristotle ever says is said casually. He selects his words carefully. Character, in his opinion, may be the most powerful persuasive technique for human beings. This statement is remarkable, especially when I think about how often people tell me that they never speak about themselves when trying to persuade because they do not think they should be part of the story. For Aristotle, not using character to persuade would be like not using a sail in a sailboat. We should note that in the context of persuasion, character refers not to the moral or ethical traits of the communicator, but, as in a play or movie, to the traits the audience sees in the person before them. Aristotle continues. Secondly, persuasion may come through the hearers, when the speech stirs their emotions. Our judgments when we are pleased and friendly are not the same as when we are pained and hostile. It is towards producing these effects, as we maintain, that present-day writers and rhetoric direct the whole of their efforts. Persuasion, he claims, can come when the right emotions are aroused in the listener. Most people, I suspect, would agree with him on this point. Almost everyone has experienced being moved by a tragic speech in a movie or a thundering speaker at a political event. However, most people have not considered exactly why it is that emotion can have such a profound, persuasive effect. Nor have they typically considered how their own emotions have been aroused by the skillful communicator or what happens when a corrupt speaker arouses the wrong feelings in them. The use of emotion in persuasion is such a difficult thing that it is exceedingly rare to see it done well. Most speakers either avoid emotions altogether or fail to produce the right ones, often with unfortunate consequences. To character and feeling, Aristotle added a third means of persuasion. Thirdly, persuasion is effected through the speech itself when we have proved a truth or an apparent truth by means of argument suitable to the case in question. Argument, then, is the third element in Aristotle's persuasion trilogy. In argument, we include logic, witnesses, facts, and so forth, all of which, when arrayed well and presented effectively, can persuade someone that something is true. He summarizes his rules as follows. There are, then, these three means of effecting persuasion. The man who is to be in command of them must, it is clear, be able to reason logically, to understand human characters and excellences, and to understand the emotions, that is, to know what they are, their nature, their causes, and the way in which they are excited. There we have it. Character, emotion, and argument are the three modes of persuasion. Aristotle, living in an age when oral communication was the primary means of persuasion, made his claims with regard to human speech. But, as we will see, his insights apply to any form of human communication, including film, poetry, music, art, social media, and even advertisements, whether for products, policies, or politicians. Whenever and wherever human beings persuade, the three techniques that Aristotle discovered are in use. Some of you may be wondering why it is that Aristotle chose to write about persuasion at all, and the question is important to consider. About a century before Aristotle was born, the Persian emperor Darius sent a great army to conquer the collection of city-states we now think of as ancient Greece. The opposing forces met at a place called Marathon, where the Greeks won a remarkable victory. 10 years later, Darius' son Xerxes decided to repeat his father's quest with the largest army the world had ever seen. Some accounts say it contained over 2.5 million soldiers. This time, the outcome was decided in a great naval battle fought in the narrow straits off the coast of the Greek island of Salamis. Much to Xerxes' surprise, the Greeks led by the Athenians emerged victorious yet again. Within a year, Xerxes' army would be completely repulsed, never to return. With the Persian wars behind them, the Greeks, especially the Athenians, found themselves at peace, wealthy, and living in a radical democracy in which every citizen could, at least in theory, influence policy and government. As its democracy thrived and as Greece grew richer and more powerful, Athenian society changed in ways that made the ability to speak and convince critical to obtaining and maintaining social and political power. As the rhetoric scholar Thomas Habeneck has noted, rhetoric came into being as a technical discourse due to the high value placed on oral communication, persuasion, and deliberation in the emerging city-states of the ancient Mediterranean world. New frameworks for collective decision-making, as well as the substitution of formal legal procedures for violent conflict resolution, required participants who could clearly articulate issues for others and move members of an audience to decisive action, even when their individual or family well-being was not at stake. In addition, the expansion of political and cultural communities beyond kinship networks and the persistence of such communities over time required the articulation of unifying ideals and cultural memories through formal procedures of praise, blame, and recollection, responsibility for which gradually passed from priests and poets to orators and statesmen. The democracy of Athens did not have representatives or senators. Individuals were free to propose laws, make policy suggestions, or bring lawsuits against those they believed to be enemies of the state. In the latter case, someone who was sued by his neighbor or accused of a crime had the obligation to defend himself in public courts. There were no defense lawyers to argue on one's behalf. If we pause for just a moment to consider such a situation, we can understand why persuasion came to dominate the education of anyone with political ambitions, social goals, or great wealth to protect. As the classic scholar James A. Arrieta tells us in his Philosophy of the Ancient World, the new form of government, democracy, validated by its success against Persia, brought to the fore the mechanism of persuasion. An ability to persuade had been admired from at least Homeric times. But now democracy revealed the urgency of acquiring it. An ability to persuade meant political power in assemblies, legal success in courtrooms, and the esteem of one's fellow citizens. Good speakers became leaders, and perhaps for this reason, the word in Greek for speaker, rhetor, is also the word for politician. A market developed for those who could teach the art of persuasion, and there was no shortage of teachers hawking their skills. Alert Greeks understood the double-edged nature of rhetoric, which could be used both to educate and to delude, and the resulting ambivalence toward rhetoric became a stimulating subject for philosophy. Like a young software genius moving to Silicon Valley today, it was in this exciting and vibrant environment that the young would-be philosopher arrived, explains Arrieta. Aristotle, born to a physician in Stagira in northern Greece, came down to study at Plato's Academy when he was about 17 years old in or about 367 BCE. By now, the Persian Wars had been over 100 years, the Peloponnesian War more than 35 years. Athens was prosperous, active, civilized. The external scars of defeat had passed. Tragedy, philosophy, and rhetoric were flourishing. The rival schools of Plato and Isocrates were flourishing. Demosthenes, perhaps the greatest orator the world has seen, was commencing his career. Trade and manufacturing, depressed during the Peloponnesian War, were in vigorous revival. And the world came to Athens to be educated. And the crowd of those who came was the 17-year-old Aristotle. He entered Plato's Academy. He stayed for 20 years. In addition to the social and political motives that made persuasion almost an obsession for educated Greeks, one other factor contributed to this phenomenon, the Greek language itself. It is almost impossible for the speaker of a modern Western language to comprehend the ways in which ancient Greek could be used and abused in support of persuasion. LaRue Van Hook's translation of a work known as the Encomium on Helen, in defense of Helen of Troy, which was a fairly standard rhetorical exercise in Aristotle's day, written by one of antiquity's most famous rhetoric teachers, Gorgias of Leontini, gives us some sense of just how far a skilled Greek speaker could manipulate his native language to suit his rhetorical goals. But if by violence she, Helen, was defeated, and unlawfully she was treated, and to her injustice was meted, clearly her violator as a terrifier was importunate, while she, translated and violated, was unfortunate. Therefore, the barbarian who verbally, legally, actually attempted the barbarous attempt should meet with verbal accusation, legal reprobation, and actual condemnation. For Helen, who was violated, and from her fatherland separated, and from her friends segregated, should justly meet with commiseration rather than defamation. for he was the victor and she was the victim. It is just, therefore, to sympathize with the latter and anathemize the former. It was this combination of factors, among others, that led to the flourishing of schools of speaking and persuasion in Greece. Aristotle, now in his intellectual prime, looked around at the wide range of teachers and guides, both good and bad, competing for clients and fame, and he decided to create his own work on persuasion. It was not meant for wide circulation. Rather, it was a set of private notes, or perhaps a textbook for students at his own school, the Lyceum. Whatever his motivation, he did us a great service, for in that comprehensive volume, he laid down the basis for understanding this most fundamental human activity. In chapters 2 through 4, we shall take a deeper look at each of the three modes of persuasion. For now, though, let us look at the modes at work in some well-known examples, as they may help illustrate the remarkable power of Aristotle's insights. Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. In July of 1863, the armies of the Union and the Confederacy fought the deadliest battle ever waged on U.S. soil in and around the small town of Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It was a bloodbath for both sides, and when the battle was over, General Robert E. Lee withdrew his Army of Northern Virginia and marched south toward home. As he did so, President Abraham Lincoln urged the Union General George G. Meade to pursue the rebels, for Lincoln believed that capturing Lee's forces could force the South to surrender and thus end the war, whose cost in lives and treasure weighed heavy on many Northerners. Lincoln believed that a segment of the Northern population wanted to make a deal with the South, so he urged Meade to find and capture Lee. As Stephen W. Sears writes in Gettysburg, his comprehensive history of the battle. At an Independence Day fireworks display at the White House, Elizabeth Blair Lee encountered the president, and she recorded him telling her, "Meade would pursue Lee instantly, but he has to get food for his men." And at a cabinet meeting, according to diarist Gideon Wells, the president said this morning, with a countenance indicating sadness and despondency, that Meade still lingered at Gettysburg, when he should have been at Hagerstown or near the Potomac to cut off the retreating army of Lee. He feared the old idea of driving the rebels out of Pennsylvania and Maryland instead of capturing them was still prevalent among the officers. For several reasons, Meade decided not to pursue his enemy. Lee and his army safely returned to Virginia, and the war would continue. Lincoln knew that this development would be a bitter disappointment to many in the North, and that he would need to persuade these Americans that the continuation of the war was right and necessary. So, on the afternoon of November 19, 1863, 4.5 months after the Union armies defeated those of the Confederacy at the Battle of Gettysburg, President Lincoln stood before citizens and soldiers at Gettysburg and delivered his famous address. For the purposes of my analysis, in the print and ebook versions of this book, I indicate passages that employ the element of character in italics, passages that employ argument with underline, and passages that employ emotion with an asterisk at both ends. Next is the speech. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth upon this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives, that the nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Lincoln begins by telling the audience that their fathers were noblemen, dedicated to a lofty proposition, as he reminds them that as president, he is the representative of their illustrious ancestors. Lincoln assumes for himself and shares with his audience a character that is at once lofty and visionary. Lincoln then notes that they have come together to dedicate a final resting place for the fallen. A person who, in the midst of war, pauses to honor the dead and to give them a sacred and protected eternal resting place is a person of deep moral strength. In this short opening, Lincoln creates a character that immediately ennobles him as a speaker and his audience as listeners. Lincoln next presents the argument that his and his audience's actions on that day are not a matter of opinion or whim. What they do is fitting, namely in keeping with the standards of their society, and proper, namely in accordance with moral principles. Lincoln then pivots as he suddenly seems to realize that what they have come to do is impossible, for it has already been done. The dead soldiers have consecrated the ground for all Americans, a statement that both reinforces his previously stated argument and unites his audience with the fallen in a common purpose. Lincoln makes an appeal that as the dead have done their part, so now the survivors must do theirs, to continue the war until victory is achieved. It is a great task, he says, and one that falls upon the Union to complete. This argument presents a moral obligation, a debt, that the dead have placed upon the living, that the living must pay in full. Having made his argument that a debt exists and must be repaid, Lincoln briefly returns to character, urging his audience to devote themselves to the cause for which the Union soldiers gave their lives, and then back to argument, stipulating that what is imperative is that the fallen should not have died in vain. The latter is an argument of equivalency. Tens of thousands of dead is a great cost, and it should not be paid by the nation without gaining something in return. For Lincoln, the only reward that justifies the loss of so many dead is the preservation of the Union. It is because of his belief in the supreme value of that Union that he ends his speech with a persuasive figure that is at once a promise and an exhortation. In this final phrase, Lincoln repeats the word people three times, as he did with the phrase we cannot at the start of his second paragraph. Noting that government of, by, and for the people must not be allowed to perish, this is an emotional cry for help, a save me from the imperiled young democracy to his audience, asking them to set aside their anger and exhaustion and to persist in her defense. Any patriot hearing those words should feel a deep sense of responsibility, of righteous determination, and most importantly, of inspiration and hope. Time has not diminished the power of Lincoln's words, which is why, to this day, his address is the only presidential speech in American history that has been honored with a hallowed name. It is not Lincoln's words or Lincoln's speech at Gettysburg that every school child learns. It is the Gettysburg Address that persuaded us, and in many ways continues to persuade us, that the Union is something we must all, each in our lifetimes, do our part to preserve. As Gary Wills, who wrote the definitive analysis of the speech, has noted, the Gettysburg Address has become an authoritative expression of the American spirit, as authoritative as the Declaration itself, and perhaps even more influential, since it determines how we read the Declaration. For most people now, the Declaration means what Lincoln told us it means, as he did to correct the Constitution without overthrowing it. By accepting the Gettysburg Address and its concept of a single people dedicated to a proposition, we have been changed. Because of it, we live in a different America. Fire and Ice by Robert Frost. Robert Lee Frost, one of the greatest U.S. poets of the 20th century, is remembered for works such as Stopping by a Woods on a Snowing Evening and The Road Not Taken. He also wrote a short poem of 9 lines called Fire and Ice. A main theme in Frost's poetry is that human life is basically lonely, lived by many in psychological isolation. Frost's tragic and sorrowful life influence the often bleak views that permeate his work. In this poem, Frost sets out to ponder the end of the world. We can diagram the work as follows. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say in ice. From what I've tasted of desire, I hold with those who favor fire. But if it had to perish twice, I think I know.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?